Welcome, everybody, and we're really in a wonderful situation today because Janice Foster Richardson is with us, and she's quite an inventor. She has been the founder and initiator of the grassroots grant makers, and this is a novel organization that has done some very unusual things that enhance the capacities of local people to be producers rather than consumers. So, Janice, I wonder if you could give us a little background. How did this organization come about, and how has it evolved?
Well, hi, John, and really great to be with you today, and thanks so much for the invitation. I'm such an admirer of the work that you and Peter are doing together, and Abundant Community is one of my favorite books. So Grassroots Grantmakers is a network of people who are associated with primarily with funding organizations, and primarily in U.S. and Canada, and we had our roots about 20 years ago, actually, with about two dozen community foundations who were trying to get a little closer to the ground in their communities. There was a national initiative, actually, that the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation launched to encourage community foundations to work a little closer to the ground. And so the people that kind of were the beginning group that kind of found each other out of interest in just learning and sharing and together and kind of exchanging notes and stories about what was working to kind of get funding closer to the ground in a way that's really meaningful. That's how our group started. So it was like very informal. It was very associational. There wasn't any sort of grand master plan in the beginning. But over about for the first 10 years, it worked like that. But more and more, I think there was sort of a growing interest, very much at the margins of organized philanthropy, but of people in foundations or funding organizations, and I would say, you know, other kinds of like city governments, the United Ways, other kinds of institutional groups who were somehow rooted in a place and had money, resources to give that they wanted to give in a way that was closer to residents in the community. They were sort of asking a question of, you know, what can an institution do that with money that is meaningful to everyday people in a community? So over the years, you know, it's like more and more people sort of found each other through our network. And in 2004, I came on board as the first staff person. And so we now have, we very much describe ourselves as a thinly staffed network. So we try not to be too heavy in the center. We still have a real strong ethic of people learning together. And think of pretty much everybody in our network are innovators in their space, people that are, you know, certainly in the funding world, but, you know, really trying to do things in a different way.
When you, at the present time, how many people or groups do you think are in the network?
You know, there's a couple of ways to answer that, John. You know, I can say that people who have officially raised their hand and say we want to be a member, and, you know, their members do contribute some money as members, and that's what sort of keeps our network going. It's what pays the little bit of bills that we have to pay. But of the member organizations that contribute money, there are about 45 of those. And all across the U.S., and we have four member organizations in Canada as well. And then there's a larger circle of people who, you know, we know about, we feel like we have somewhat of a relationship with. They may tap in from time to time on conversations that we host as, you know, as webinars, or they may come to an event that we put together, but really, you know, aren't paying members. We So we think about sort of the, the immediate family, and then there's an extended family of organizations out there. And then, you know, we're discovering people all the time. So we're discovering people who, and people discover us, who are, really innovators in this space that we describe as grassroots grant making.
You you really have described in part, it seems to me, a learning network. As you say, you're not trying to be too heavy at the center.
Exactly.
And I'm just wondering, as you have participated and observed the developing thought of grant makers about how we relate effectively to local communities, what kinds of things do you think have emerged in the thinking of grant makers as a result of that?
Well, one of the core practices, I'd say across our network, something that kind of shows up just about everywhere, and there's, a lot of learning around that, is what good, kind of gets to the heart of, what good is money? So when you talk about everyday people on a block in a community someplace, how does money enter into that picture? And a lot of times the core practice across our network involves funders learning how to use micro-granting, little bits of money, so grants, making available grants of anywhere from $100 to, I'd say probably the top limit is about $5,000. But little bits of money that we describe as, I almost hate to use the word small grants because they're really not small to the groups that are receiving them. But what is unique about, in the funding world, about this type of small granting is that the intention is to make these grants available to groups that the funder might not ordinarily hear from. In fact, really it's the associational groups out in the community space. So sometimes groups that might not even have a name. And one of the places that we have learned a lot from is Denver, from the Denver Foundation, and they're making their grants available to, they say three unrelated people on a block are eligible to apply. And that is, very, very different. So if you kind of switches the kind of the mindset that goes with the kind of granting from, how do you qualify a group if it's not providing services and it's not got all of those external things that, 501c3s and official board of directors and a lot of long organizational history that funders normally look for. So some of what the learning has been is, how much risk is there in that? How do you tailor a grant-making program to, to really work with small amounts of monies into groups that aren't professional grant seekers? Maybe you've never applied for a grant before. Maybe don't even have a bank account. So how do you do that? And then, so there's some practicalities about that. And then other parts of it kind of go into, how do you really connect all that you learn from being in relationship with a whole different set of people in your community. How do you bring that into your foundation work so that what you do can really, so that you can really learn from people in the community and make better decisions?
And in your gatherings, is it a sharing of that kind of learning that is a major activity?
Yes, yes. In fact, we, while we certainly, I think everybody in our world, we try to read as much as we can and stay up on research. What we're really focused on is providing opportunities for people to learn together in community. And so we host, instead of a conference, our decision is what we've, we were very purposeful in saying we try to host another type of event. We call them on the grounds. And we've struggled with, are they learning gatherings? Are they, what are they? But we definitely know they're not a conference. They always happen someplace where someone in our network we think is doing was doing some interesting work, and that could just be about anywhere in our network. But people are willing to host us and then share with us what they are doing, but then help us enter into a conversation really that's really about learning about what has been learned there, what decisions have been made there that have really been informed by that particular community's culture and history and context. And then from that, how can we all take that back into our own communities and think about how that applies there? So there's a lot of emphasis on connecting people together. Also, one thing that's unique, I think, about our gatherings is that we're really, really excited when there's more than funders in the room. So a lot of our members bring with them other people from their organizations or from their community partners. And we're especially excited that most of the time there are residents from the community level, people who are involved in associations. Who are in the room with us. So we have what's unique in the fending world, a very mixed up conversation that includes everybody that's in the mix and not just funders talking about people in the community, but people talking together.
You're really trying to take class, doing something about the class structure and trying to take that off the table. And I think I came to one of yours, because my memory's slowly returning.
Yeah.
You also give a lot of emphasis to place in the community discussion. Everything now, everybody wants to build community. Everybody's part of communities. But it seems to me that your place focus. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. There are a whole set of funders out in the world who really do identify with the place. And, when they speak about what they're there for, as they say, we're here to make this place better long term. And so the most typical way I think a funder would approach a place is to fund all the nonprofit organizations in that place.
Right.
And what they're doing really is funding, kind of creating creating good services. They're funding charity, or they're funding the services that are provided in that place. And, as we, I assume just about anybody attracted to this call today would have sort of figured out, and people I think in our network have figured out, services are important, but, they're not the whole answer. And so I think, the place, the focus on place in our network kind of comes from we are focused on this place. And if we're going to really be effective and do what we're really here to do, we have to expand our lens to include everybody in this place and not just fund nonprofit organizations.
It's hard to know how to do the right thing with money. Like, it's something very complicated about it. And you see all the efforts that go into it. And yet you still see almost the same levels of poverty and reducing incomes and divested neighborhoods. And, why is it so difficult to make a difference among the most marginalized and poorest people of this culture or a city or something like that? Any thoughts about that? Simple question.
Well, I would say that is probably the most complicated question I can think of. But I do think, what I have noticed, and I have noticed both from the community side and from the funder side, is that the crazy thing that happens is that when you bring money into a picture, people almost kind of get into a trance. And so it's kind of undoing that trance that I think is, needed to kind of get to the heart about, what can money do about anything about that? There's some part of the trance that goes with, I think, a sense of responsibility to the money, that we want to be responsible and do the right thing. And so kind of over blows kind of efforts to be accountable and to minimize risk. And you want to, if you want to be accountable and minimize risk, you want to have things like very, very predictable. And
right.
And I just don't think, you know, I think predictability and innovation don't go together. So, you know, I think in our efforts to be accountable, responsible, you know, we've thought if we could fund the most predictable organizations that we can fund and, you know, try to make sure everyone has well thought out plans and we can trustworthy and tried and true and tested, that we would get the results that we want. And I think over time, what a lot of people are discovering is that enough money, enough time, the best thinking is not generating the results we thought they would, which was, you know, communities that are good places for everyone.
That's a great insight, Janice, just that sentence. You know, we thought time, people, money, management, or it would get us the results, and the reality is has not gotten us the results.
Mm-hmm.
That's
Janice, one thing I was wondering and particularly interested in the idea that if you're talking about money, you don't want to use the word small, but I would say mm-hmm. not a lot, right?
Mm-hmm.
$100, $200. If you begin to think at that scale, I remember Henry Moore, a person you knew, a city manager in Savannah, he used to say the important thing about our smaller grants is we want to make sure that they are always the bait and not the fish.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if your funders and their discussions have learned some things about what makes money a valuable asset in terms of assisting people to be productive, which is the reverse of services, which is that you're increasing their capacity to be clients. Do you see any patterns that people have found or discussed about what $100 or $200 can do? If I had $100 or $200, what have you learned about how that might enhance the power of locality?
Well, there's we talk a lot about small grants as an invitation. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
think about, you know, what motivates people to get together at the community level. Like, why would I want to go next door and talk to my neighbor about an idea I have? Well, sometimes, you know, it's a crisis that motivates people, or maybe something that is, you know, happening in the community. Often, you know, what I find is, you know, people have a dream, and the dream may be powerful enough that may take them next door. And but, you know, one of the things that I think it's really quite a simple thing, but there is some magic that goes with an opportunity to apply for a grant. If it's presented as an opportunity and it's presented in a way that it seems not like a bunch of hoops to jump through, it seems like something that is doable within reach,
mm-hmm.
Then it really can be, you know, it can kind of help a person who has an idea say to themselves, like, okay, here is this invitation, and there's actually a starting point to it. Here is something that's going to encourage me to go ahead and move on this idea that I've had and mm-hmm. check it out with a neighbor. See if I can get two or three people who are also interested in this, and then part of the application, actually, if it's done in ways it's not in funder jargon, that is really ask questions that are really helpful to people and go moving from a dream to something practical that they can do together to get started. So if the questions can help them create some together, some initial steps, and then figure out, encourage them to figure out what resources they already have that they can apply to that, and then where a little bit of extra money might come in handy, then, you know, I think, you know, the biggest thing that we've learned is just how this opportunity of applying for a grant can really be perceived as an invitation that's enticing enough to kind of move, to get some energy going. That's really sort of already there in a way, but just to nudge it forward a little bit.
And so one thing that this requires of a funder is that the idea of the actual goal and activity comes from neighbors.
Yes.
Whereas a lot of funders are really providing the idea and the outcome definition and then recruiting neighbors around their definition of what is to be done. And this is the opposite. This is what you're inviting is definition.
Exactly.
Of purpose and goal and commitment. And that seems to me to be a very difficult change for foundations to make.
It is, and it, you know, the tagline for our network is actually, you know, reflects that thinking. It's we begin with residents, and it's like we collectively, all of our, of all the groups in our network, aspire to work as a funder from a position of beginning with residents, and that we initially, as we were kind of putting our organization together, we started off with in neighborhoods with residents, and someone within a group said, oh, no, you know, I know I could name a lot of funders who believe they are in neighborhoods with residents, but they're with their own agendas. And what we really mean about this is that we begin with what residents want to do.
If you do that, you sort of then, in your accountability as a funder, mm-hmm. and whoever's money you have, you're faced with some way of explaining what the outcome is.
Yes.
We're going to flow with and support the definitions of neighbors and things that they indicate they're willing to do, and we can give them a little support. And now I'm going to tell the board of directors, and the reason we're doing this is that what will come of it is. How do you answer that board question?
Yeah, and that is actually, you know, once we kind of get over the practicalities of, you know, how to get a small grants program up and going, and, you know, there's some practicalities there. It's not brain surgery, but there's some wisdom that can be shared about that. Then you get to the really hard question about sustaining the work, because it is those questions that come back from the top executives in a foundation or the board members about, so over time, you know, what can we expect from this? Where is this going? What is this money actually doing? And what we see what we've learned is that down the road, unless you can really put some flesh and bones onto those questions, you know, if you can, you have to help people get out of their heads about that and actually have some experience across the table or in the community with people to actually see what is happening. If you can see what is happening, you can see the relationships, the energy, the creativity, you know, all the, particularly in communities that are very distressed and may have been seen as not being able to, you know, where sort of communities of poverty. If you can get out and see, you actually can see and feel. But if you can't see, if you have to talk about it, you know, what to talk about the thing you don't want to talk about is what the money was spent for. Because what you're going to find there is you're going to find T-shirts, you're going to find food, you're going to find shovels, you're going to find a bunch of stuff that doesn't really have anything to do about the relationships that have grown in the community. So what you don't want to do is talk about the stuff. What you want to talk about is people who have moved a dream forward, who have who have deepened relationships, who have used this one experience to then do something else together that probably didn't need a grant, that you're helping to support people in building relationships that will be useful and certainly in times when a community really needs to pull together in terms of any kind of problem or disaster, when it's just people in those communities that have to respond right then. But then for, you know, enriching people's lives. And so all the mutual aid and collective action
mm-hmm.
comes with just, you know, more relationships. So to kind of get to what you're getting to, you're not getting to, you may have a garden, but it's more than a garden. It's about the people behind the garden, that you just have to keep turning the conversation back to that it takes, that it's what people do in a community that matters and how they see themselves in that community.
And that's what I hear in the description of some of the effects that may be the result in part of the support of the money
mm-hmm.
is that what the outcome you've been describing in my mind is we are acting as a citizen.
Yeah.
We were sitting at home, right? Maybe with imagination, maybe with possibilities.
Yeah.
We sat at home.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have engaged with other people in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And we've done the following kinds of things that have magnified to other people in the neighborhood and purposes. And it seems to me that of all the things one could invest in, it is the sort of renaissance of productive citizenship, and that's the outcome, I think, that is basically what's being produced by people who are doing what you're talking about.
Yes, exactly. And in some cases, you know, what we have seen is that sometimes it's the block club or the three unrelated people on a block who get together the first time. Sometimes they'll get together and they'll want to stay together. Or sometimes they may even, you know, decide, may work on something together and then kind of want to get to the bottom of, well, why are there so many vacant lots here? Why isn't there anything for kids to do after school? Or why isn't? And so in some cases, people do form a group that can be, you know, stays together over time and may tackle some of those, you know, policy level questions. They may organize together. They may, you know, they may initiate things that look more like a social change agenda. But what we, you know, what we've learned over time is that it's those three people getting together the first time, that unless you continually sort of nurture and invite people into that citizen space, then, you know, if what you're wanting is social change, if you're wanting citizens to get together and challenge structures and systems that are keeping things and maintaining situations of poverty and disadvantage, unless you are continuing to try to encourage and nurture that citizen space, you'll never get to that policy
yeah.
change.
I know we want to have the other listeners join the discussion, but one other thing. On your website, or do you have documents or materials that people who are interested in this area might access?
We do, and everything is available and free, regardless of, you know, whether a member's or not. So there's no secret doors or locked places. We have And we have stories. We have a document bank that includes all kinds of examples of things that people have developed, from grant applications to, you know, just kind of you name it, anything that's sort of needed in a grant process. But you know, we have a lot of information there, and we just like welcome anyone to come and find what's useful. The only thing we ask is if you learn something that you can contribute back, you know, please share it back, and we love to get people's learning in the mix.
Can you tell us what the website is?
Yeah, it's www.grassrootsgrantmakers.org. And the only thing tricky about that is that grassroots and grantmakers are both plural, and it's all strung together. Grassrootsgrantmakers.org.
And it's listed, it's on the chat. If anybody's logged in, they can let
us know.
One question before we open to questions. What disappoints in this process? Where does the process not work? You know, all the things you're talking about, the scale, the mindset, the those that have initiated, your accountability methodology, which is really a meeting, a conversation, a relationship to see what's happening rather than hearing. Those are all amazingly powerful ideas, but what's disappointed you over time? What's hard about this?
I've just seen amazing people do amazing things that are often at the edge of their own foundation. And so, you know, I think when I talk to people about starting out in grassroots grant making, you know, if I'm talking with a foundation that's trying to organize a program, I'll say one of the most important decisions to make is who's going to staff this program. Because that person has to be someone who is really good about building relationships and really sort of multicultural, really great out in the community, but also great inside the foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And because there's learning on both sides, I think when I've been really disappointed, I've seen the foundation thinking it's all about what happens out in the community, where there's really a lot of learning that has to happen inside. It's like, how do you show up in a different way? How do you use all these insights and these relationships that you're building with a whole other part of the community to think about who you are and how you do your work? And so when I've been really disappointed, I've seen what looks like fabulous work that's facing out and a fabulous person that's staffing it who has sort of no access inside a foundation to tables where people are talking about what do we do about the schools in our community. And so those tables continue to be tables that are dominated by social service organizations.
You tried to think of a gentle term, didn't you?
Yeah.
I know. It's a colonial mentality is what you're fighting, but you're creating alternatives to.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You're trying to create a communal mindset.
Yeah.
And what you've been so successful with is this, as far as you have gotten a long ways inside the foundation mentality to try to make that shift.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite amazing when you look at who you brought together and what you've done in places like Cleveland and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Maggie, any calls that we can respond to?
Not yet, but let me remind people that we really would love to have your participation in the call. And if you would like to, if you're calling in from your phone, you can hit *8 and I will see that come up and we can include you into the conversation. Or if you'd like to log in a question, comment, reflection into the chat, please feel free to do that.
Oh, while we're waiting for that, you're retiring at the end of this year, Janice. I read that on your website today.
Yeah, and I'm using the word retirement because I'm leaving the network after 10 years, and I'm sort of hungry to kind of get back closer to the community level and have a little bit of break from trying to keep a thinly staffed an organization going. But the word retirement, someone clued me in that as you say retirement, particularly if you have some gray hair, people smile and say congratulations.
it's an early eulogy.
Yeah.
What any particular kind of questions that will most interest you that you'll have the freedom to explore?
About 10 years ago, I moved to a rural community in Texas. I moved to the place where my elderly parents retired, and I moved here to be with them at this point in their life. And the last 10 years, I've been on the road so much that I haven't showed up much here. So I'm really interested in getting connected in a real authentic way to my community. And particularly in thinking about what we can do to kind of spread a spirit of hospitality and welcoming here. So,
are you an immigration? You live in an immigration country?
Yes. This is my first time in a rural area. I've lived my life in cities, and I'm in a town of 2,500. And I'm kind of curious, and we talk about ourselves as a city of hospitality, and I found, frankly, it's been kind of hard to show up as a new person here.
Hospitable as you thought.
Yeah, I think people's spirits are in the right places. It's just, it hasn't been a place where there's been a lot of in and out over years, and so I'm curious about that, and I also. I'm hoping to stay connected to the funding world, but kind of get to be in a position where I can tell more stories about what is going on versus being up at such a being freed so much with the management of the network and. Have more freedom to sort of delve into places that I see really innovative work and help to be a storyteller about those places.
That'd be great. Is there, since you mentioned the managers, any keys or, to manage such a loosely coupled network like you've done for so long, what help other people who there's a lot of alliance building going on in the world now. I think people kind of know they can't do it on their own. Any wisdom or insights you've gotten from keeping managing such a loosely coupled group?
Well, I've certainly experienced the tension of, I think what we all think success or sort of taught to think success is that success is marked by a bigger budget and more staff every year. And so, we have been tempted to go down that road, and we found that, the more we go down that road, the more it gets to be about what's at the center versus what the network actually is in its, in its full possibility place. And so I think just the challenge to keep things very flat is really hard.
Yeah.
And that means, not doing everything yourself. It means sort of letting go every day, which is really hard, particularly if you don't see people face to face. I guess the other thing, Peter, I'd say about that is I think there's some magic of, you have to know how to use technology well, but then... the times when you're together face to face has to be very personal, very, very much in person. And so that's the reason we try to make the events that we sponsor be as intimate as possible.
Right.
And we don't have them in hotel ballrooms. We're in community spaces. We're knee to knee. And we're in conversation, and that high tech and high touch, I think, really go together.
Yeah. Now, there's a question on the chat saying, other than Seattle and Savannah, do you have a story of other cities that have done this well?
Well, Peter, I think you just mentioned Cleveland, and that's where we're going to be this year for our On the Ground in September. And I think Cleveland, this work is so alive and well and flourishing and just sparking with innovation there. It's really quite amazing that Cleveland Foundation's Neighborhood Connections Small Grants Program is one of the biggest scale in the country. Actually, it's really remarkable when you think about how much money is given out in very little bitty ways. It's over 10 or 12 years have been literally been millions of dollars. And I think what Cleveland is it's been so innovative and helped push thinking about is that the grant making committee that is composed there is all of community residents. So we describe that as resident-led grant making. And there's been quite a journey there of what that means and how to do it well in a way that, really is about residents being residents and not sort of turning into more typical funders. So Cleveland is certainly a place.
Janice, if somebody wanted to follow up on this, what would the website be?
Same website.
Yeah,
Tom's organization is called?
It's called Neighborhood Connections, and I think his website is neighborhoodgrants.org. But if you Google Neighborhood Connections, you'll be able to find his organization. It's really remarkable. And actually, so we are hosting our on the ground learning exchange this year in Cleveland, partnering with Tom to kind of share all this good work.
Great.
Anything specific you can mention that they've done, been so smart about or clever about?
Well, I just wanted to say we do have a caller with the question. So after Janice answers that question, we'll take the caller.
Okay. One of the things that I, other than the resident-led grant making, that I think has just been really remarkable just about how Tom O'Brien, who manages that program, thinks is over years, a lot of grants, but he keeps thinking about, so how do we connect the people that have received these grants over time? And so hosts a lot of things in the community that really connects people who have stepped forward with ideas and dreams and passion and energy. And so, what's kind of moved from a bunch of isolated little groups is really a community, a more connected community, because he sees himself part of the job of this program is to not just get the money out the door, but to connect people at the community level. And
has the city been involved in that at all?
Yeah, the city has been involved, and I know the arts organization in Cleveland has been involved, and so, there's all kinds of powerful ways that arts can be used to show up and, really inspire people to move into citizen space. Then there's a lot of exciting work in the Greater University Circle area, connecting residents in with those big institutions, Cleveland Clinic and Case Western Reserve University, museums in the area, kind of trying to level the playing field so people can really talk and work on community together.
That's great. Well, maybe we take the question now. Thank you, Janice. Maggie?
Okay, sure. Hello?
Hi. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Mark. We have a community development corporation, a 501c3, located here in central Vancouver, and we're using the asset-based community development framework for the revitalization of the Fourth Plain Quarter, which is located in central Vancouver, a very economically depressed, culturally diverse area. And we, to facilitate the implementation of the ABC methodology, we We created an MOU with a lot of our institutional partners, in particular Clark County Public Health. And my question goes back to the point you shared about what's happening with the Denver Foundation. And we're in a similar sort of conversation with our local community foundation. Are you aware of any examples where a 501c3 organization in partnership with institutional players would facilitate as a fiscal agent these sorts of small associational grants that we might be able to tap into some of the wisdom they've gleaned from their efforts?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, Indianapolis comes to mind right away, and that it's an organization there, the Indianapolis Neighborhood Resource Center, that's actually been the home for the micro granting program there. And is, you know, it was really a smart way for the funders in that in Indy to you know, kind of get into that work, and that they had created, there was some interest in pooling some resources, so creating a little pool of resources that wasn't owned just by one foundation, but they were looking for a trusted community partner to help manage the program. And so went to Indianapolis Neighborhood Resource Center. They already had the relationships out there, were trusted, had experience working in the community community level, and they just did a really good job. So they're one, and actually, you know, there's others around the country. So that is a model that has been used, and that has been used and worked really well.
Excellent. And then the only other caveat I have is in regards to John's point about generating a client attitude. We've been striving to be very sensitive to the potential of us becoming a consumer-generated agent as opposed to a client-mobilizing agent. And so just really interested in, you know, how can we, you know, prescribe something like this in a way that it doesn't come across as creating a dependent relationship for these entities to grow from. So that's just an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's something there about sort of expectations. You know, are you expecting groups to formalize and grow, or is it okay if the group stays, is the three women on the block, three unrelated people on the block? And I think, you know, as long as you have room for all of that to happen, and, you know, what I would hope you wouldn't say, and I shuddered a little bit when I heard this, someone was talking about their grassroots grant making program. Someone asked, like, what successes that they've had, and they said, well, over the years, X number of groups have gone on to become nonprofits with their 501c3s. And I'm thinking that, you know, that is not success in my mind. It's not failure if some groups go on to do that. You know, people can decide what the right path is. But I think, too, as long as, you know, what you're not doing is expecting groups to go along that path, and either, you know, you are intentionally or unintentionally nudging them that way, things, you'll be just fine.
Excellent. I just really appreciate your point about be clear about what your definitions of success are. Thank you so much.
Yes.
I think that could be the name of your book, Janice. three unrelated people on a block.
Yeah.
I love that.
Right.
Any more in line, Maggie? Hope we haven't lost Maggie.
Oh, sorry. I have to unmute myself if I want to talk. there are no more callers calling in, but there was a clarification from Dan in his earlier question in the chat that he was asking about city government.
Yes. There's been some, like, really marvelous work done by city governments. I think a good friend, Jim Deers, in his book Neighbor Power, tells the story of his work in Seattle with the city government in Seattle. And so that's a real go-to resource and a lot of wisdom in Seattle. Also, you know, I've seen great work happen in the city of Orlando. The city of Orlando has been one of our members in the past. I think, you know, there's a little bit different, you know, one of the hurdles people have to get over in the institutional world is, you know, how do we give money to something that doesn't look very organized or doesn't have the, you know, sort of the things that we think we have to have. And I think city governments, with all the bureaucracy that goes there and all the extra expectations regarding accountability for money, often, you know, it's harder for them to give money to the three unrelated people on a block. So in some cases, I've seen money given, you know, and money gets reimbursed with it instead of given right up front. Sometimes the list of things that need to be purchased gets submitted and things get purchased for groups. I've seen that, you know, handled in various ways. What I really love to see is people to kind of get over that fear, but you know, sometimes there are regulations folks have to abide by, and so I'd say the best way to connect, to learn how you can kind of get through city bureaucracy is to talk to someone who's done it, and I can certainly connect you with people.
And you'd pick Orlando and Seattle. Jim's book, the title is?
Called Neighbor Power.
The Seattle Community Building, the Seattle Way, something
Building Community, the Seattle Way. And I'm actually looking for it on my bookshelf. I can see it over there. I just can't read the
title.
James Deers is the author, D-I-E-R-S, and it clearly is a document describing one of the very most innovative approaches by local government to sort of enhance the life and power of people in neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
We also have our phone call with him, John.
Coming up.
Website.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So that's an even quicker way.
Yeah.
One
other nearing the end of the hour. Any final thoughts? If anybody wants to call in or Janice or John, you were going to say something.
I've just been out in California with two city governments, and their desires follow the directions we're talking about. But you can see that governments have a kind of restriction in terms of taxpayer accountability.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That is limiting. But one of the things that I could see with these groups is they saw themselves as leaders in terms of bringing the local United Way and bringing the local community foundation into becoming small grantors, right?
Yes.
So that's another very useful function of cities. Take leadership in getting other funders to open their giving to this approach.
Yeah, John, that's a great point. I'm so glad you made it because I've seen, and actually the experience that I had when I was working at a community foundation in Memphis, city government was partner with us. And they had, there was red tape they really couldn't figure their way through to give money for granting. But they did partner with us and help some other things happen, help some of the connections, you know, things that they call technical assistance that if, you know, done in a really sensitive way can be really helpful, you know, to help some of the stories get told. So they could put their resources and, you know, and all their relationships into the mix. It's just that, you know, to use their money, the money that they had to figure out their way through the red tape on that was a little complicated.
Yes.
I've seen that happen in that way in other places. So city government in partnership with others who might have a little more flexibility on the granting part of the money really has worked well.
Good.
Great point. Janice, any final things you'd like to share with us? Thank you. It's just been wonderful what you've done over these years and the 10-year commitment you've made and the kind of successful radical shift in thinking. Even the idea that can you give money to people who seem disorganized? That's another book title. I love that. That should be a condition for the grant is we are disorganized. Can you give us?
We don't quite know all of what to do yet.
And you're inviting connections.
We are inviting connections. Well, I just want to, you know, thank you again for the opportunity to be here. And I think just, you know, what I really feel like there is, you know, it's when folks feel it's easy to feel discouraged, but then when you look out at, you know, like what is really happening at the block level across the U.S. and Canada, and I know internationally we just haven't had the reach to really listen and hear and learn internationally, but when you really see what people are not just thinking about, but what they're actually doing, it is so encouraging. And there are, you know, there are institutional players out there who are figuring out how to be supportive of that. So I just think I just want to leave on a word of, you know, really a hope and possibilities.
Great. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much, Janice.
Okay.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Yes, Janice. Thank you. Thank you very much. Janice and Peter and John, we appreciate the time that you took to be with us today. And thank you to our listeners and for Mark for calling in. We appreciate that. And Dan for the question in the chat. If you'd like to know more about grassroots grantmakers, visit the website www.grassrootsgrantmakers.org. We'd like to invite you too to join us on our next call, which will be May 13. It will be with Ed Everett of nextdoor.com. Until then, please visit our website, www.abundantcommunity.com, and stay in touch with us. This brings our program to a close today, and thank you so much for joining.